1932, Basel Arbitrage Corporation against Landmark Corporation.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eric Pelton, and I represent the appellant in this case, Nassilov Coating Corporation. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please, for rebuttal. The key issue before the court today is, did the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board err in applying grave preclusion prevented appellant's petition to cancel the registered mark of appellee Nylock Corporation?
What about the compulsory counterclaim question? Is the question of trademark validity a compulsory counterclaim in action for trademark infringement?
No, I think the holdings in this court in Jett and Mayor Berkshire make it clear that the petition to cancel is an entirely separate set of transactional facts, and there is no compulsory counterclaim. In addition, the earlier action was not adjudicated or litigated at all. It was a default judgment.
Are you suggesting that Rule 13 doesn't apply to default judgment?
No. I'm suggesting that the clear precedent of this court in trademark matters is that the compulsory counterclaim rule doesn't apply, but that the standard set forth in Jett is what applies, in which there must be an identity of the parties, a prior final judgment, and the same set of transactional facts.
But Jett wasn't dealing with Rule 13.
Rule 13 has not been, is not before the court on this issue either. It's never been brought before the board or on appeal.
Compulsory counterclaim. I mean, the whole question of race judicata claim conclusion against defendant is a very complicated question. There's a lot of law there that's really not treated in either one of the briefs. And one of the arguments for claim conclusion with respect to the defendant is that something's a compulsory counterclaim, that you're obligated to raise the issue of validity in response to the infringement claim, and that having failed to raise a compulsory counterclaim as to validity, it's too late to do it wrong. That would seem to be one of the arguments.
Well, I think that those are the key issues that led to the same issues that led to the determination in Jett and Mayor Berkshire that registration is a separate matter for which the board and the trademark office is given authority, and that regardless of what type of earlier action there is, that a subsequent action for cancellation is a separate set of transactional facts which reaches the same result that there's no claim preclusion and that there was no mandatory counterclaim in the earlier action.
Well, what happens here? Let's suppose you succeed before the court. Isn't this a mechanism for collateral attacking the earlier default judgment? If you could get the mark canceled before the board, you'll go back to the district court and say vacate the injunction to now determine that this is an invalid mark.
Well, that's...
Isn't that what your plan is?
That's a hypothetical. The issue before the court in the district court judgment was infringement, likelihood of confusion, and really all that the district court determined was that appellee owned federal registrations and that they were being infringed.
Let me answer my question. If you succeed before the board in getting the mark canceled, would that not be then become a ground for collateral attacking the earlier default judgment?
It may be, but this court has held that the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board and the Trademark Office has the authority on petitions to cancel, and that they're not mandatory to be raised in an earlier, that cancellation is not mandatory to be raised in an earlier infringement action, precisely because they're a different set of transactional facts. Here, the cancellation issues are fraud, phantomness, genericness, lack of acquired distinctiveness, which do not have anything to do with the likelihood of confusion issue, which was alleged by appellee in the earlier action.
But as Judge Dyke points out, you could have raised all of these issues in the first case as a counterclaim or even as affirmative defense.
Had the prior case been adjudicated, those issues could have been erased, but they were not mandatory. there was a default judgment, yes.
The question that I have, there's a statement in the file showing that you were served on February 3rd, 2004. The client was properly served at that time. So they had notice of the action.
There was an issue over service that was brought to the appellate court, but it was determined that it was determined that they were served. It was determined that they were served.
The only said that there was a 120-day rule which did not apply to foreign service. Was your client served specifically on February 3rd, 2004?
That's not a part of the record. I don't have that before me.
Right here in the record, it's in the appendix. In the memorandum which was submitted, and it says, Maslach was properly served with a complaint. The court order was specifically found that the record shows that Maslach received proper service of process on February 3rd, 2004.
Okay. I will not contest that they were served.
So you have no procedural due process argument saying that you did not receive proper service.
If there was an argument for that, that would have been appropriate to raise in the district court or in the appeal, even though they weren't a direct party to the appeal.
But as Judge Dyke points out, the rules of compulsory conduct that could have been raised in that particular action. And if it's a compulsory counterclaim and you did not raise it, then you're just stopped from raising it up.
Well, it's our position that that is not the issue that came before the board on summary judgment. That is not the issue that has been appealed and briefed by either party.
I don't understand that. I mean, they certainly argue in their brief that it was a compulsory counter. I'm not sure that's right, but that is an argument that the board's not having. You know, there are only two arguments for preclusion of the defendant in these circumstances. One, it's a compulsory counterclaim, which they should have raised and didn't, and you're precluded as to that. The second argument is that even if it's not a compulsory counterclaim, that because it's a collateral act, basically, on the earlier judgment, there's claim preclusion. There's a whole section right in the middle about that, like 50 pages, which nobody mentions in those cases. Other than those two arguments, you're right. The claim preclusion doesn't apply against the defendant. But you have to address the question of one of those two arguments applies here, whether it's compulsory counterclaim, in which event you lose, or it's really a collateral attack on the judgment, in which event you lose.
Well, the board's decision hinges on its interpretation of the rule set forth in Jett and the three elements of identity of the parties, prior final judgment, and arising from the same transaction.
Yeah, that test is dealing with preclusion of a plaintiff's claim. There's a different test for preclusion of a defendant.
But defendant is not now trying to raise the same claims. The defendant could have raised issues regarding likelihood of confusion. They could have succeeded in avoiding, had they defended the infringement action, avoiding the infringement action on numerous bases without ever attacking the registration. It's our position.
Well, that's the problem. You can't just sit there and not raise the defense and then say, well, we got a default judgment against this. We'd like to proceed in this other forum, and then we'll use that to collaterally attack the judgment. That's the problem. You understand what I'm saying, right?
Yes.
I gather that your position is when the other forum is the administrative agency, whatever might be the general rules, if you were to try and go to a district court now and bring some sort of declaratory action on the same premises, that might be collaterally stopped or precluded. But that such rules don't apply when you go to the TTA, when you go to the trademark office. And that's really what I wonder about, as to whether, in fact, such rules do apply when the first decision was a district court decision.
Right, and we...
And that was a question. Why should such rules apply? It's irrelevant whether you did or didn't defend in the district court.
Because the Trademark Trial Appeal Board and the Patent and Trademark Office has been given sort of the primary authority over registrations.
But they're certainly bound by the law of the land. And which then they're part of the judicial system in the administrative sense.
Yes. I'm not sure I understand your question. I'm trying to address it to the extent I understand.
I'm trying to understand why the rules should be different for the TTAB than if, in fact, you had gone into a district court and raised this challenge, having declined to defend and received an adverse default judgment in the first district court.
Well, in JET, the court says that they are different transactional facts for numerous reasons. Those reasons include that the...
I think what Judge Newman is asking is that should the rules of race judicata be different because the second proceeding is before the TTAB?
Well,
the answer to that is no, right? It's the second rule of collateral estoppel of race judicata, right?
Well, the authorities from the board and from this court have clearly held that an earlier infringement action does not bar a later cancellation, whether that infringement action was contested or defaulted or resulted in a final judgment.
The question is, shouldn't the same rules apply if the second proceeding is before the TTAB is applied if it's in a district court?
Well, that's a decision not for me to make. But here, they're different. The rules as they currently exist are different for the board because the board is not barred by prior compulsory counterclaim or a prior action when it comes to a petition to cancel. It's been held that that action before the board is not the same transactional facts, and therefore that claim is not barred from going forward.
Does that confuse the facts with the nature of the action? The transaction facts are, it seems to be, identical in that the issues are, that the lots are the same, that are dealt with in both forms, and the grounds for challenging the lots are the same. The only difference being that in the first form, your client declined to present such a challenge.
The grounds are.
It could have been raised.
The grounds are not necessarily the same. The grounds of the earlier action were likelihood of confusion for infringement.
Because there was a default. There were no grounds raised by your client. Isn't that correct?
Correct. But my client could have defended that action and merely, and won based on no likelihood of confusion, if that were the case.
He lost. There's an adverse judgment.
Yes.
Against
him. Yes.
So, what provides the opportunity to start again in another form?
Well, because the cancellation is a separate issue. The registration
it's
and
a
the
separate remedy.
And
the issues are the same.
The issues are not necessarily the same. In my belief, but it certainly is a separate remedy. It is a separate remedy,
and
it's a separate cause of action.
Because as a named defendant, your client declined to defend.
Yes.
So he received an adverse judgment. Was it excused? Was it adjudicated? But I'm trying to understand why, on those facts, one can start again in another form.
I can reiterate that the Trademark Office has the authority over registrations, the primary authority over registrations, and that it's been held that an attack on a registration, regardless of any prior actions or defaults on an infringement issue, does not preclude the Trademark Office from reviewing the claims of cancellation.
Unless the cancellation action was a counterclaim, mandatory counterclaim in the first action. If it was mandatory, then you lose, right?
Well, even in... even in one of the cases, I believe it's Vital, where there is a mandatory counterclaim that had been asserted, but then had an adverse judgment in the first action, and the board did not preclude hearing a cancellation. Vital, I may have the case names mixed up. In Vitaline, there was a counterclaim brought by the defendant, and then the same party later brought an action to cancel the same mark, and this court in 1989 held that the claim preclusion did not preclude it from going forward at the TTAB.
This morning, may it please the court, Richard Megan on behalf of the Appellee Nylock Corporation. I want to begin by addressing the Vitaline case. I think my opposing counsel misstated. In Vitaline, they applied claim preclusion based on the earlier counterclaim. So there was claim preclusion in that case. One other thing I wanted to point out is Nasalock's counsel argued that the trademark board has sort of exclusive authority over registrations of a trademark. I don't believe that is correct. If you look at 15 U.S. Code Section 1119, dealing with power of court over registration, it provides that in any action involving a registered mark, the court may determine the right to registration, order the cancellation of registrations in whole or in part. So in the earlier district court action, Nasalock could have asked, in addition to asking that the mark be declared invalid, that the mark be or asking the district court to order the cancellation of the registration. So not only could they have made the entire claim and arguments, but also the relief as well, ordering cancellation of the registration.
Let me give you a hypothetical. There's a district court action for infringement of a trademark, let's say with respect to goods in Class A, and there's a failure to make a claim for cancellation or to challenge the trademark. But then there's a second district court action for infringement with respect to a different class of goods, okay? Can the defendant in the second action raise the defense of trademark invalidity? I know that's not this case. I don't understand very clearly. In the first case, it gets an injunction against using the mark for Class A. But then the same plaintiff wants an injunction with respect to using Class B.
And I assume it's the same parties in both cases?
Yes, same parties in both cases.
I would say no, and here's the reason why. If you look at the Jet case...
No preclusion.
I believe there would be preclusion.
There would be.
Because one of a necessary element of a trademark infringement case is that the trademark owner have a valid trademark. The Jet case establishes that when it looks at the transactional facts. One requirement is a valid trademark. So in the earlier case, the validity of that trademark would have been part of the infringement claim.
Yeah, the problem is that, I don't know if you're familiar with Holdcup, but we've suggested in the patent area that the second suit for infringement with respect to different goods, that you could raise the invalidity challenge.
I'm familiar with the Holdcup case. I think one of the differences between a patent case and a trademark case is, in a patent case, the validity isn't maybe a compulsory counterclaim, but it isn't an affirmative part of the infringement claim. In a trademark case, one of the necessary elements is a valid trademark. And that's because in a trademark infringement case, you don't necessarily need a federal registration to assert a trademark infringement claim. You can be relying on common law rights.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's the difference between trademark and patent cases. But in any event here, if the mark were declared invalid, that would be a collateral attack on the original judgment, right? I mean, the only products that are issued are the same products that were issued in the first case, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the exact same issues, the exact same products, the exact same registration.
Well, you know, it could be descriptive as to some goods and not as to others. So I think you don't want to generalize too far.
But in this case, we're dealing with nylon self-locking fasteners, so the goods are identical in both cases. And to answer another question, we are asserting both a compulsory counterclaim and that they're attempting to collaterally attack the prior judgment. And then there's one other point I wanted to make, is that there's an important factual difference between this case and the Jet case. And that important factual difference is that the mark that was the subject of the later cancellation proceeding in JET was different than the mark, the trademark asserted in the earlier trademark infringement case. Specifically, the mark that was the subject of the later cancellation proceeding was the appellee's mark, AerobaJet, whereas the trademark being asserted in the earlier case was the appellant's mark, JET. Here we're dealing with identical marks. Also, in the JET case, they attempted, JET, the appellant attempted in the district court action to bring a cancellation claim and was denied leave.
It was a point of conclusion case, JET.
Yes.
Right. Right. Makes a big difference.
Yes, sir.
Well, the issues that were raised in the trademark office generally seem to have tracked the issues that those defendants that did defend in the district court had raised. However, this, over your, in this case, this particular defendant raised no issues. And so why should that defendant be collaterally stopped from going into the administrative tribunal?
Well,
challenging the pressure of the existence of this
one. Well, the reason is that because claim preclusion not only precludes claims that were actually made, but claims that that could have been made and should have been made. And it's the latter problem, that they had notice and every opportunity to raise the exact same arguments and seek the exact same relief we're seeking here.
So is there a difference between what could have been made and what must have been made as compulsory?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's no difference.
There's no difference. The arguments are identical in terms of what they're asserting here and what they could have asserted. And I don't think there's really any dispute because...
Well, that's all the trouble. I mean, I don't think that the breach to have covered it just as far as allowed to cover everything that you covered by collateral estoppel. They don't
need to be saying... No. Perhaps I misunderstood the question. I'm not saying... we're relying on claim preclusion saying that the prior district court action, that the claims for invalidity in this case should have been asserted as a compulsory counterclaim or as an affirmative defense.
What you're saying is if they win this before the board, they can come back in and get rid of the very judgment that they don't like.
Exactly. And I submit that's why they brought this case. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr.
Newton. Thank you, Your
board's decision clearly states that it comes before the board on Nilex's motion for summary judgment on the affirmative defense as claim preclusion, and later that under the doctrine of claim preclusion, the judgment on the merits, quoting JET, and then the three-part rule from JET. And it's clear that claim preclusion is the key issue before the board and before this court, and that in JET and Mayer Berkshire and other cases, that it's been held that the registration attack is not the same set of transactional facts as the prior infringement action. And as you noted, that there is a difference between arguments that could or should have been made in an earlier action versus arguments that must have been made, which obviously is whether there's a compulsory counterclaim or not. But here, the arguments, they were not required to have been made. As the law of this court has stated in JET and Mayer Berkshire, because of different transactional facts. And one issue, one reason perhaps behind the rule is the public's interest in a registration. The fact that the registrability in an infringement action may be primarily an issue of likelihood of confusion, but that there are other grounds for attacking a registration, such as genericness, descriptiveness, fraud, and that these issues are before the trademark office because of not just the interest of the party bringing the claim, but because of the interest of the records of the trademark office and the general public.
But all those could have been brought before the district court.
Could have been, but in, we assert we're not required to.
Now, as far as vitamin is concerned, do you agree with the police counsel that
I misspoke regarding the holding in Vitamin.
You're not citing the group, so I presume it's not a case in your favor.
Well, actually, it's one case that I'm aware of where claim preclusion operated to prevent the subsequent cancellation. And it's a very unique set of facts in that the issue, the first action was based on whether or not there was fraud regarding a declaration of continued use, a Section 8 affidavit. The attempt at the second cancellation was based on abandonment, and inherent or tied up in the abandonment was the same fact that when they made this Section 8 declaration, they were not using the mark. So it was held that claim preclusion was triggered in that case because the facts, the same facts, the same evidence were necessary to both claims. If I'm happy to answer any other further questions. Thank you for your time.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.